I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump went to a black church in Detroit on Saturday trying to improve his image and standing among African Americans, most of whom do not support his presidential candidacy. The Pew Research Center found that while Trump is seen as the least religious of the candidates this election season, a majority of white evangelicals says he has their vote. Hillary Clinton has talked about her Methodist faith, and again, according to Pew, she's getting most of the secular, agnostic, atheist, and nothing in particular vote. So how much does the faith of a candidate matter to voters? How does God talk this year compared to previous years? We also want to look at church attendance, attendance at religious places of worship, and the public's changing religious habits. And this is something that Emma Green has been writing about. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. Emma Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
I do want to get into this interesting attendance to places of worship. But why do you think faith has been so central to our politics? And perhaps it's changing now, but why so central?
From the founding of the United States, faith has been an important part of the distinct character of America. It's a country that was founded on religious protest and on the notion that people should be free to practice their religious faith. I think that has followed us throughout 250 years of electoral politics. And even though today people's patterns of religious attendance and affiliation are changing, I think it's still just as important as ever that politicians demonstrate to the electorate that they have some sort of connection to a brand of faith, whether they're in the GOP or the Democratic Party.
Do you think it matters depending which party? Do you think one party's more religious than another?
Certainly, the Republican Party has a greater reputation for religiosity and for attracting the votes of conservative religious Americans. However, this election has been interesting because it's sort of turned that stereotype inside out. The Democratic National Convention was full of religious language, and Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine have, especially over the past couple of months, started to ramp up their use of religious language, while Donald Trump, on the other hand, has won the affection of evangelical voters, but hasn't necessarily scored highly on all of his Bible school type tests throughout his time in the campaign trail.
And just picking up on that, the little wine, little cracker commented at Bob Jones University, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, and things like calling a book of the Bible 2 Corinthians, little dog whistles that suggest he's not necessarily as familiar with Bible study, church practices, being part of a really robust religious life as some conservatives would like him to be.
Well, let me talk a bit about the piece you wrote about religious attendance and affiliation. Are we seeing fewer people attending places of worship today?
Absolutely. And what's remarkable about today's American electorate is that fewer people are religiously affiliated than at basically any other time in American history. This is particularly true of American young people. What that means is that people aren't claiming Catholicism or claiming Presbyterianism in as high rates as they did in the past. And that also translates to how often they show up to church. There are some people who still show up faithfully every Sunday, every Wednesday, but a lot of people are tagging out because they either don't have faith in the religious institutions or there's too much other stuff going on in their lives to prevent them to go.
Other stuff like what? Sleeping in, going food shopping. I'm thinking of all the things that we try to jam into our weekends.
Absolutely. I think for some people, religion just doesn't matter. It's not something that's important for them to spend time on. But I think, as you mentioned, there are some families for whom getting to church is just really hard. It's hard to wake up your kids one more morning out of the week to go sit still in a hard pew for several hours when you could be doing so many other things like staying in your pajamas.
What about, though, institutions? And is there a kind of either a mistrust or just a lack of connection with the institution of religion?
One of the things that's so interesting about the way religiosity patterns have changed in the United States is that there's this whole class of people who are the nuns, as sociologists call it. So these people I was referring to before who don't necessarily claim one faith or another, these people aren't necessarily not religious, and they aren't necessarily even atheists. Actually, relatively few Americans are atheists. They're often people, as you say, who don't necessarily trust religious institutions or don't identify with the way a particular church or pastor frames morality or their teachings on Jesus. And so these people may be sort of in between, trying to figure out their religious lives without attaching themselves to one institution or another.
And that's N-O-N-E, not to be confused with N-U-N, right?
Right.
But are they searching for something, or are they content with the fact that they don't have this affiliation?
I think there is certainly a population of people in the United States who don't care about religion at all. And that's atheists, agnostics, people who just don't really care. But, you know, I think one of my strongest convictions, at least in talking with people, reporting, looking at the demographic patterns in religious affiliation, is that the types of questions and ways of thinking that religious groups have often traded in, so asking moral and ethical questions about how to live your life, thinking about death and marriage and birth, thinking about existential questions that I think plague everyone, those are questions and ways of thinking that matter to everyone. And so even though religious affiliation and institutions might be changing, I think religious questions are no less relevant than they've been at any point in American history.
Let me give out the phone number, and that's 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You also, though, talk about the fact that, yes, there are these either nuns or people that are not going to church for a whole host of reasons, but also that there is at the same time what appears to be a religious revival. Take us into that world, Emma.
One of the amazing things about American religious life today in particular is the diversity. So as you said, there's a whole chunk of people who maybe aren't that religious. But on the other side, there are many people who are finding their way into a more traditional religious practice, or who are finding for the first time a church community that they might identify with, or a deeper iteration of Islam that they really identify with. I had a really interesting reporting experience in Houston this year talking to young Orthodox Jews who had found their way into a more traditional version of Judaism late in life and had decided to embrace that and make that their own. And I think for a lot of those people who are, again, seeking out the way that religion and religious questions feel right to them, sometimes this can be the right path, which is finding your way right back into a conservative and traditional version of things people have been doing religiously for hundreds of years.
Can we say that immigrants are more or less religious than native-born people?
Certainly. Immigrants, and especially immigrants coming from Latin America, are much more religious than most Americans who have been here for one, two, three, four, or more generations. And this is largely Catholics who are coming from Latin America, but there's also been a Protestant and charismatic evangelical revival among people in Latin America in recent years. So more and more Hispanic immigrants are actually Protestants as well, evangelicals.
Well, let's talk about the church that Donald Trump attended as a child. You wrote a really interesting piece about it. When he was growing up in Queens, I guess what, the 1950s, who attended this church? First church, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right. And this was one of those churches that embodies every stereotype that you can imagine about American churches. It's white clapboard on the side. It has these beautiful stained glass windows and balconies. And it also embodied the stereotype of American demographics in the 50s. It was largely white, middle and upper middle class people, families of businessmen and lawyers and professionals. And it was really dominated by sort of those stereotypes of the 1950s baby boomer, perfect Leave It to Beaver family.
Right. And today, a very different congregation.
Absolutely. Just like Queens, First Church has gone through a significant transformation over the last 50 or so years. And what's happened is that slowly the white people have left. They've gone out to the suburbs or back into the city. And immigrants, largely from the Caribbean, actually, and Central America as well, have come into this church and have made it into their own. They've done outreach for immigrant groups from different parts of Latin America. They've done outreach to Islamic centers in the Queens neighborhood, and they've turned what was once a white, middle-class, suburban-style Queens church into a vibrant immigrant community, and actually largely in defiance of trends elsewhere in the Presbyterian church nationally. So they've been able to take a sort of old-line, old-school Presbyterian church and turn it to something that is remarkably successful.
You describe I believe it was a 4th of July service, and the minister speaking to the congregation. What did he say? And not that everything is about Donald Trump, but what did he say that seemed to be a reference to Donald Trump?
Well, you know, nothing is more patriotic than attending an immigrant church on the 4th of July. There was so much patriotism. We all sang America the Beautiful together. People were wearing American flag T-shirts. But the pastor, speaking in somewhat veiled terms because of the limitations on what pastors are allowed to say from the pulpit, basically was talking about political candidates who are only able to speak about their own accomplishments and praise themselves rather than those who humbly seek out and ask questions of others and who look to welcome in others, especially people who are of minority faiths, so for example, Muslims. And this was remarkable because on such a patriotic display inside of a church, it was very interesting to hear this pastor seemingly slam the Republican nominee for his lack of patriotism drawn in a different way.
And how does Hillary Clinton talk about her faith? She's a Methodist. She's not as overt, I think, as some candidates have been. But what do we know about her religious leanings and beliefs?
Hillary Clinton has a long record of demonstrated commitment to Methodism. This is something that's been documented since before the time she became the First Lady of Arkansas, how she would carry around a dog-eared copy of the Bible that had verses marked in it that were particularly meaningful to her. But especially as she has come into her own as a figure in public life, as she's been a senator, secretary of state, and now a candidate for president, she's been a little bit more reluctant to speak openly, specifically about Jesus, for example, or God. What we have seen in the past couple of months is an uptick in drawing on some of the sort of humanist or generally acceptable rhetoric that comes from John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, which is to do all you good in all the ways you can, for all the people you can, as long as you can. And this is something she's repeated over and over at political events, drawing on that Methodist heritage, but not necessarily marking it out as something that's religious or not religious.
Emma, we're almost up on a break here, but what do you think her reluctance is about?
I think Hillary Clinton is a consummate politician, always trying to navigate between multiple bases, trying to, in this election, navigate between the vibrant left movement that was represented by Bernie Sanders, while also trying to get as many of those centrist Republicans and moderates and independents that she can from Donald Trump and the Republican campaign for president. I think what she's trying to do is show that she can appeal to as many people as possible, and calling out her religiosity is not necessarily a winning strategy for that. I think you could say on the flip side that there are benefits to her speaking openly about something that's clearly so important to her, but it seems so far that's been her tactic.
And that's Emma Green. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. We're talking about the role of religion in our lives, in people's lives, and also in our politics. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Got another guest who'll be joining us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. I've been talking with Emma Green about politics and religion, something that she's been writing about for The Atlantic. Also, people's changing attendance and affiliation when it comes to religious institutions. Joining us now is Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times, also a political analyst for CNN. And Jonathan Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is David Gibson, and he's national reporter for the Religion News Service. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Jonathan, let me begin with you and actually go back to something I said at the very top of the show, the fact that Donald Trump went to this black church in Detroit. Do you think that in any way helps his standing among black voters?
Oh, I think it may help a little. I mean, a very little. But I think the demographics are pretty much locked in when it comes to this election. You can look at the polling over the last few months, and it's pretty clear to see which sort of groups in this country are favoring which candidates. I think he is doing that because, you know, he is widely seen as somebody who is racially divisive or a flat-out racist, and that's a deep concern inside their campaign and something that they're trying to address. I don't really think that they believe he can get some, you know, huge swath of the black vote. It's more about trying to reassure the larger electorate that he's not a bigot.
David, let me turn to you as someone who's a national reporter for the Religion News Service. Just how important do you think religion is to black voters?
Well, religion's really central to African-American voters. It's so funny when we talk about, you know, evangelical voters as such a key voting bloc, and they really are, especially for the Republican Party. But, you know, you have to understand black voters are also evangelicals. They're, you know, not the white evangelicals who are so associated with the GOP. But black voters, you know, they're motivated by their faith. They come out to church and they come out to the polling booths in November, you know, very much based on their faith. And it's just a different, obviously different priorities than white evangelical voters have. So, and in an election, you know, again, the polls go back and forth, but it's going to be close. And these are the kind of voting blocks that are going to make a difference.
Jonathan, I'm going to put this to you, but Emma and David, I'd love to have you weigh on this as well. And we were talking, Emma and I were talking about the fact that there seems to be less, quote unquote, God talk this election season. But I wonder if there aren't some proxy issues, whether it's LGBT issues or wedding cakes or ISIS or abortion or even things like climate change. Jonathan, you want to take that? And Emma, I'll get you and also David.
Sure. I think it's less about religion and the nature of a candidate's faith, and it's more about identity. This is really an identity election. It's about what kind of country do folks think that we should be in, and what the country stands for right now. It's about much more fundamental matters beyond the individual religiosity of the candidates. This is about matters of race, of terrorism, you know, as you mentioned, and of, you know, much more fundamental questions. I think that's in part because the Republicans nominated somebody who is basically secular, who is not a regular churchgoer, who is not comfortable in talking about his own faith and talking about scripture. That's not who he is. And if you look at previous, you know, Republicans, George W. Bush comes to mind.
Sure.
They were comfortable in that realm, and that's just not who Trump is. Hillary Clinton is actually a devout Methodist, but her politics are sort of conventional center-left, and she's never been all that comfortable talking at length about faith. She will, and she's certainly capable of citing scripture, but it's not even like her husband, who came out of a sort of Southern Baptist experience and was very much at ease in the pulpit. So I think it's A, the nature of the two candidates, and B, it's just the nature of what's at stake in this election, which is much more about, you know, identity than it is faith.
What do you think, Emma?
Well, one way that this campaign has been interesting is that, again, it's flipped some of the narratives of historical campaign dynamics on its head. You mentioned a couple of social issues, for example, like LGBT issues or wedding cakes. You could also think of the bathroom controversy in North Carolina. And you could even toss in issues like abortion. These have traditionally been central concerns for particularly conservative religious Americans, especially evangelical Protestants. And for a large part, these issues really haven't gotten billing this election cycle. Donald Trump has spoken to evangelicals on the topic of Supreme Court justices and abortion, but for a large part, he has not made that a central piece of his campaign. So I think there are certain ways in which identity issues, insofar as they are conservative social issues or social issues that are important on both sides of the aisle, they've been played down to a large extent. I don't think that means that religiosity is less important, but I do think that speaks to the profiles of these two particular candidates and the issues that are on people's minds, such as the economy, security, immigration, as Jonathan was saying.
David, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, kind of picking up on what Emma said. Also, in a way, the culture war has flipped. You could almost ask, who are the culture warriors now? The Democrats are talking about, you know, gay rights and abortion rights and all these kinds of things. And the Republicans are really not talking about those things at all. They're kind of running away from them, if anything, in part because of who they have as a candidate. So in a sense, I mean, if you were there in Philadelphia at the Democratic convention those last couple of nights.
Indeed we were. Yeah, no, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, obviously. And it was, you thought you could have been at a Republican convention or something for all the red, white, and blue, the chants of USA, but also the God talk. You know, the Reverend William Barber from North Carolina, from all of these things, you know, very carefully orchestrated. But the language of religion, the God talk, was much more prevalent at the Democratic convention, and it was almost absent, entirely absent at the Republican convention. There was no talk of abortion, no talk of gay rights. In fact, Donald Trump, said he would protect gay rights. So, you know, I think there's been a real flip. It's not so much an absence of God talk. I think it's there. It's just a different register and by different people.
Well, that's interesting. And Jonathan, let me go back to you. You described Donald Trump as basically secular, and I was talking with Emma about his comments about a little cracker, a little wine when he was at Bob Jones. When he was at Bob Jones University. But it's so interesting that white evangelicals, as a group, see him as their guy.
Yeah. Actually, that was in Iowa, summer of 15, not Bob Jones. But
okay.
That's fine. It was striking to me, speaking of conventions, to witness Donald Trump's hour-plus speech. The word abortion or the words sanctity of life never once crossed his lips. It's extraordinary for a Republican nominee to never even mention that issue, even in passing, in his speech. And that's because I think he has made a conscious decision that the culture wars that he wants to litigate are about race and identity, not about sex, right? It's not about abortion, or it's not about transgender identity. It's not about gay rights. He wants to litigate culture wars owing to race and identity. And so, you know, and frankly, that's where a lot of the party is now. Mm. And that distresses traditional conservatives who are Christians a great deal, because they have just the opposite view. They do want to litigate sexual culture wars, and they want to be much more accepting when it comes to race and identity. It's a really fascinating debate within the conservative movement, sort of seeing that unfold. Why are evangelicals accepting of him? It's less because of his personal faith and more the idea that he's a strong leader who they see as somebody who will protect their values. He may not be of them, but he's somebody who will look after them. And I think, you know, it's also rooted in deep contempt for Hillary, right? A lot of that vote is that he's not her. They're voting against her as much as they are for him. And then lastly, it's the court. He is
Supreme Court.
Supreme Court. Yeah, he's not great, but you know, he is more bound to appoint a better justice for them than she is.
That's Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for the New York Times, also a political analyst for CNN. Emma Green, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She covers politics, policy, and religion. And David Gibson, national reporter for the Religious News Service. And we are talking about the role of religion in our political lives among the candidates. And also, Emma Green was talking about how attendance and affiliation is really changing when it comes to the American public. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I do want to read a couple of comments here. But, Emma, let me first go to you. And picking up on what you and I were talking about, this notion of attendance and affiliation, and I wonder whether Donald Trump really reflects how of the changing American religious habits. He doesn't seem like he attends church very much. He doesn't talk about his faith very much. And I wonder whether he's a reflection of a lot of people in this country.
I think that's a great way to put it. He, in many ways, represents a commonality or a common story among religious Americans or even non-religious Americans, which is he has a religious story. He went to Sunday school. I visited the Sunday school where he attended. He allegedly goes to a Presbyterian church now, but there have been some doubts about whether he's actually a regular member. And he doesn't necessarily have the kind of biblical literacy that someone really dedicated to their faith otherwise otherwise might. I think that he does represent some of that slide in religiosity among the general electorate, but I don't necessarily know that that in itself would be a major point of appeal to a large number of Americans. If people don't really care about religion, it doesn't seem as though religion or lack thereof would be the number one issue that they would premise their vote on. And as Jonathan was saying, it's likely that they're attracted to other parts of Trump's campaign, whether that has to do with identity politics and immigration or has to do with his foreign policy and views on trade.
David, let me read an email question. A listener from Stone Harbor says, what are your thoughts on the DNC's use of Bernie Sanders' atheism and or his Jewish identity in trying to manipulate Southern white Christians? I'm not sure if you believe the premise of the question, but it was interesting, I think. And for months, I'm not sure people thought much about Bernie Sanders' religious identity or not.
Yeah, that was a fascinating episode. That was when that was kind of the final straw that led to the fall of DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, when the latest WikiLeaks came out and showed all those DNC internal emails, and that someone had suggested maybe, hey, we can use Bernie Sanders' atheism against him in the primaries. I think it was in Kentucky, somewhere in the Bible Belt. You know, here's this Brooklyn-born Jewish, secular Jewish atheist. Although, again, he's actually not an atheist, or he doesn't profess to be that. You know, I think it's an example, one, of how, you know, religion is, frankly, for campaigns, just another marker in terms of rallying people or turning voters off or on to a certain candidate. It's also interesting that they kind of, you know, and Hillary Clinton, her campaign, you know, a Democratic campaign would use that, or would consider using that kind of talking point against Bernie Sanders. But also, Bernie Sanders, in many ways, if you followed him, as all of us did, John and Emma and I, you know, he was one of the most religiously literate candidates out there. He went to visit Pope Francis in the Vatican.
That's right.
In the midst of the primaries. He's a great fan of Pope Francis. You know, he's one of those, again, he doesn't profess a particular belief. He's culturally Jewish. But he can talk about you know, good works and the way that both the New Testament and the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, talk about the God's commandments to take care of those, your neighbor, and those who are less fortunate. So, you know, it was kind of an odd effort to attack Bernie Sanders, I think.
Let me read a tweet from Mr. C. How about addressing atheism? I remember doing a show, maybe with Pew, a couple of months or maybe even a couple of years ago about atheists, finding that people who are non-believers tend to know more about religion than people who call themselves believers. But as you mentioned, you didn't think there were a lot of atheists in this country. But do you think as we look ahead and maybe even beyond November 2016, that religion will have less of a place in our public lives?
It's interesting that atheists often gets swapped for religiously disaffiliated or people who aren't that religious, because according to Pew, actually only about 3% of Americans identify as atheists, meaning that they specifically don't believe in God and they think about their views about the nature of God kind of in contrast to religion, meaning that they're atheists, they're anti this idea of God. So I don't know that atheists themselves necessarily define the dynamics of the religious decline in the United States, even though their population is growing slightly bigger over time. I think, as you said, these people are often very religiously literate in the sense that they seem to oppose religion, and one of their goals often seems to be to persuade others that religion isn't the right path for them. I think for more people, it's more of a sense of apathy or maybe a sense of distance from the type of institution that they grew up in. And I think for some, as we were discussing earlier, it's also maybe a sense that they haven't found their place yet, that they're seeking, they're in between churches, they have a syncretic practice that mixes a lot of different kinds of faith. They're an interfaith household, they're raising children but aren't quite sure the way that they want to do that. And for most people, these kinds of in-between questions are actually much more representative of the slide of religiosity.
Jonathan, I know we have to say goodbye to you in just a couple of minutes. We've got upcoming debates. The moderators and the dates have been chosen. And I was reading some things from Barry Lynn, who's from this group, Separation of Church and State, and he talked about some really important questions that it would be interesting to hear the candidates say, including what does religious freedom mean? Yeah. What does a separation of church and state mean? What would your faith prevent you from doing? Do you think that there's a chance any of those questions will make it into any of the debates?
Oh, I think it's possible. I mean, there's three of them, and of course, moderators are always going to look for a sort of out of left field question that's a little bit unpredictable for the candidates. So I think it's certainly possible, especially because they're going to want to really draw the candidates out. But I just don't think the meat of the debate topics will be about personal faith. I think it's going to be much more about the nature and the sort of tenor of this really ugly campaign and some of the most pressing issues facing the country, both here and overseas.
What do you think, Emma?
I think that the debates are likely going to center on some of these hard policy issues, but I would be interested to see, and this is a shameless shout out to the debate moderators upcoming, I would be interested to see them put both Clinton and Trump in the hot seat on religious questions, not just in testing their knowledge of Bible verses, but specifically the way that their religious beliefs or perhaps lack of religiosity plays into their views on everything from climate change to immigration, to abortion, to LGBT issues, to even things like foreign policy and terrorism, which religion and different religious traditions have a lot to say about. I think this is something that matters to a lot of Americans, and I think it's something that the journalists who have followed Trump and Clinton on the campaign trail haven't necessarily been able to pin them down on. So I, for one, would love to see the debate moderators push the candidates in that direction.
Fair enough. Well, Jonathan, we have to say goodbye to you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, us as well. That's Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times, also a political analyst for CNN. Emma Green staying with us for the rest of the hour, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She covers politics, policy, and religion. Also staying with us for the rest of the hour is David Gibson, and he's national reporter for the Religion News Service. And we are talking about a bunch of different things, including religion and politics, religion and presidential candidates, also the role of religion in people's lives or lack of religion in their lives. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. David, let me go to you. And we haven't spent any time talking about the vice presidential candidates among the two major parties, Mike Pence and, oh my goodness, his name just flew right out of my head.
It's Tim Kaine.
Thank you very much. That sometimes happens. Now, these two gentlemen are, I would say, more overt about their religious faith than the people that they're working for.
Yes, in many respects, yes. In Mike Pence's case, not so much. It's both fascinating because they're both born Catholic, but they've kind of gone in different directions, and in some cases, it very much represents the dynamic that Emma's been talking about with modern Americans. Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, likes to call himself an evangelical Catholic, which is a nifty kind of...
What does that mean? What does that mean, David?
Good question. I wish he'd answered that. He was raised evangelical. He was raised Catholic, rather, born and baptized and bred Catholic. And then, like many during college, he kind of had a born-again experience, and he became associated with evangelical type churches, non-hierarchical type churches, and that's what he's been attending, and that's what he's been associated with. But much like actually Marco Rubio for a stretch, Marco Rubio, who also had an interesting kind of pilgrimage from Catholicism through Mormon, I think, briefly, and Southern Baptist, Mike Pence still likes to keep that Catholic label, but exactly how he can do that and still claim to be evangelical is interesting. Tim Kaine, on the other hand, is, you know, sort of more of a classic Catholic, you know, born and bred and baptized Catholic, raised in Jesuit schools, and went on a missionary trip to Honduras right out of college. Really became, you know, consciousness was raised in politics and spirituality, and he's really been a devout, church-going Catholic, singing in the choir, and somebody, you know, Catholicism is often so associated with conservative type of politics and abortion and opposition to gay marriage, but he represents, I think, that kind of broader social justice Catholicism that that, you know, you'd see in Joe Biden and some of the kind of older line Vatican II type Catholics of the 1960s and 70s.
Emma, let me go back to you. You talked about the church that Donald Trump attended when he was a child. He apparently has, as an adult, as a grown-up, and I guess living in Manhattan, attended a church that has been affiliated with Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. God salesman, I think, is the way he has been described. Does that tell us anything specifically about him?
I think to make too much of the Norman Vincent Peale connection is perhaps a stretch, but I do think there's one specific element of his legacy that you can pull out, which is the power of actually sort of secular positive thinking rhetoric that was so powerful in the way that Peale combined sort of religiosity with his self-help prescriptions. I think a lot of the appeal that Donald Trump has, and the way that he's been able to so powerfully capture a portion of the electorate, is that he knows how to spin tales of a good life. He talks about self-improvement. He talks about greatness. He talks about, for example, the way other candidates and other politicians aren't necessarily the strongest versions of themselves or haven't necessarily rallied their inner powers. And I think there's perhaps a connection here just in the way that Donald Trump has that ability to sort of sell the idea of a good life and of greatness. But I'm not sure that he deserves credit particularly for a well-developed sort of philosophical connection necessarily to a figure like Peale.
More linguistic than anything else?
Yeah, likely.
Let me get to...
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I just think I kind of agree with Emma on that point. I think the Trump might be a little bit closer to the prosperity gospel preachers, the TV, you know, preachers that you're used to from, you know, the Jimmy Swaggerts on up, you know, who are sort of the modern and more corrupt version, I would say, of the Norman Vincent Peale message and the, God will bless you with greatness and prosperity and all those kinds of things, which is, of course, a gospel that's seen as snake oil by most traditional Christian leaders, but it's a terribly, you know, popular message, certainly, among a lot of voters and in key areas.
Let me see what Paul from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
You know, first of all, that is exactly what I was going to mention.
Kenneth Copeland, Joel
Osteen, and these guys that are millionaires, and that Trump is kind of in that. I just really wanted to say, though, just to comment that whatever he shares with that particular voting block from Kansas and Texas and Kentucky and so forth doesn't have to do with joy to the world, I don't think. I think there's something else there, and it's not all that attractive, and that's my whole comment.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks. Emma, thanks, Paul. Emma, anything you want to add to that?
I would definitely echo what David has said about the prosperity gospel. It's actually interesting. The black church that Trump visited over the weekend in Detroit has a pastor who has often spoken on prosperity gospel type themes. And this was one of the reasons that some pastors in other black churches, even black Republicans, were a little bit put off by the choice that he had made to attend this particular church. They felt like the prosperity gospel tradition, although it does have a strong strain in African American churches and the Black church community, isn't necessarily representative of all Black Christianity, and in fact may spread what they see as the wrong kind of message or the message that they don't necessarily want to endorse.
We are talking about the role of religion in our lives, also in our politics. And again, Emma Green from The Atlantic is with us, David Gibson from the Religion News Service. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Interested in something that Emma and I were talking about people's changing a relationship with their houses of worship, their religious institutions. We'd love to hear from you about that. Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A question from Franco. With a number of Americans, as you say, becoming less concerned with religion, could we ever see an agnostic or atheist candidate in our near future? David, do you think that's possible?
Short answer, no. Long answer, no. I think it's amazing when you look at the polls, the surveys, that people are more antagonistic to the idea of an avowed atheist or even an agnostic, I think, being president, even more so than someone who's Muslim, for example. So it kind of goes back to that that famous kind of Dwight Eisenhower quip that, you know, Americans want a president who believes in something. I don't care what it is, he said more or less. So, you know, we want, and again, this does go to the whole issue of religiosity in America today, in the sense of, in the sense of, you know, people aren't traditionally religious in the way they used to be, but they still want somebody who reflects a certain code of morals and ethics and a way of being in the world, even if it's not, doesn't have that label. So I think there is a real, that's kind of the last frontier in terms of religion in American life. There are very few, in terms of electing someone who expresses no beliefs whatsoever. It's, I think there's only one or two members of Congress out of 535 who's avowedly atheist, for example.
Wow. An email from Edward, I'll just summarize it. He says, as Thomas Paine argued in Age of Reason, organized religions have much to answer for. But then he talks about deism. And Emma, this goes back, of course, a couple of centuries. But it'd be interesting to think or wonder whether Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist, would get elected in 2016.
I love brain teasers like this.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer to that question is, but it.
And I thought actually the question was going to be, would Thomas Jefferson approve of Donald Trump? And that's a brain teaser of its
that
own
is too.
Delightfulness.
Let's take the first one. Yeah.
I think that's a difficult question. Thomas Jefferson's politics and even his style in certain ways are somewhat antithetical to the major strains of the Democrat and Republican sort of avowed platforms these days. For example, he had a lot of views about agrarian life being really important to the foundation of democracy. When he was president, he actually was a disastrous foreign policy candidate or a disastrous foreign policy president. And so had all of these flaws that ended up not really matching to his great legacy as a founding father. People often forget that as the third president of the United States, he actually didn't necessarily do a fantastic job. Perhaps on his performance as a president, his past performance, people wouldn't elect him. And I think more realistically, his politics don't necessarily match to the left-right political spectrum that we think about today. So it's a little hard to know whether and how he would match up to one party or another.
So, candidate Thomas Jefferson, 2016. What are his chances?
slim and none. But I'm not sure how well known his views on religion were. And of course, he did respect Jesus very much as a do-gooder. You know, the famous Jefferson Bible, where he cut out all the miraculous parts but kept all of the ethics of Christianity, which in many ways may appeal to people. We may be in some. Believe a kind of functional deism today, where people are not, are not really church going or religiously affiliated, but everybody still believes in heaven. Very few people believe in hell, but nobody's quite in agreement on who's getting to heaven, except for themselves and who really runs heaven. I think what, you know, getting back to your question on atheism, I think one thing, one major theme that this whole election and certainly the Trump candidacy has brought up and brought to the fore is this whole idea of religiosity and candidates. I think especially for the Republicans, the party of God, as it were, for so many decades, the mask has slipped a bit, as we said earlier. It's so much about identity and not necessarily about religious identity. And if you look at these especially evangelical, conservative, white Christian leaders who've been endorsing Trump, there's almost debate about whether we should consider him, you know, Christian or a good Christian, whether that's even, you know, relevant. Some are saying, well, you know, he's a baby Christian.
What does that mean, a baby Christian?
Well, it's like he's just starting out. You know, we have to give him a break. He's just kind of learning the
whole language. A 70-year-old baby, okay.
Exactly. And others say, oh, he's like King David of the Bible. You know, he was an adulterer, he fell, but God still, he was still the ruler. Others are saying, you know, comparing him to all kinds of biblical figures like Nebuchadnezzar, who kept the Jews, the people of Israel, in the Babylonian captivity, or Cyrus the Great of the emperor back then, who liberated the Jews from the Babylonian captivity. Mm-hmm. In other words, he doesn't have to be a Christian. He doesn't have to be a good person or a person of faith or the most virtuous person. They want a strong man. They want someone who can lead the people of America, standing in for the people of Israel, out of this time of darkness and apocalypse.
Well, there's always that question, Emma, what would Jesus do in 2016? Another unfair question to you. I admit it.
No, I love getting to answer these historical hypotheses. This feels a little bit like, you know, the freshman college dorm room.
Yes, and
late
I apologize
at night
for that.
In the best way possible. You know, I think it's a dangerous game to try to apply Jesus to one party or another. I can't remember. I think this has been a quote used time and time again, but that Jesus is neither a Democrat or a Republican. People have said that to me many, many times when I've been reporting on the intersection of religion and politics. This frustration that Jesus is kind of reappropriated to be a political figure to match, you know, 21st century American policies, politics, when in fact he was living in a very different time. He was offering teachings that had nothing to do with American democracy, not least because American democracy didn't exist at the time. You know, I think both sides historically have tried to use Jesus's teachings as support for their policies. This has happened historically with the GOP, with the moral majority through the 90s, and now perhaps a little less so with Trump. And I think on the Democratic side, the party is just realizing that perhaps they can once again try to claim Jesus as a Democratic ally. But I think on both sides, a thing that's important to remember here, as we've been talking about, is that people who are religious, who follow the teachings of Jesus, who find him to be a very important and central figure in their lives, may vote for all sorts of reasons. And when they look at a Clinton or they look at a Trump, they may not even be thinking who of these candidates is most like my Savior and Lord. They may be thinking, okay, who would be least likely to mess up the country as I see it?
Let me read a comment from Martin. David, we're almost out of time, but I just want to read it. He says, I remain very committed to my faith and my church. However, since becoming of voting age, I've tried to consider my faith in a separate light from my preference for candidates. I feel that if I were to let my voting be informed completely by my church, I wouldn't be able to vote Republican or Democrat. For example, I'm pro-life, but I'm also strongly anti-capital punishment. And I think that's almost a perfect description of what we've been talking about this hour, about how people wrestle with their faith and our politics.
Yeah, I think that is. I think that's actually the way, you know, most people look at things. And I think, frankly, that's a healthy way to think of things, and I think a lot of religious leaders would say, you know, you need your faith to inform your political decisions and your public policy judgments, but no candidate is going to match up exactly either with Jesus, what Jesus taught, or with what you believe or what you believe is best for the country today. So, you know, it's got to inform, but you're not going to find any perfect candidate if you're a religious believer.
David Gibson, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us, national reporter for the Religion News Service. Emma Green, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. A senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. We also spoke with Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.